This is an interview with Lester R. Irwin for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program on the Korean War by Don F. Baker at 349 Arlington Street, Newton Falls, Ohio, on July 12, 1989 at 10 o'clock a.m. Okay, do you remember how you first found out about Korea and what you knew about it at that time?
Yes, I was in the Army, and I was sent over there in, I believe it was about April of 1952. I spent most of the time in Busan until about August of 1952.
What were your thoughts about going over to Korea?
Well, of course, there was a war at that time, and I was one of the fortunate ones. We did enter in at Incheon, and I was one of the fortunate ones that went south to Busan. Busan was a city where there were a lot of refugees and so forth. It was a very dirty place. People were living under bridges. They were living under in lean-tos next to houses and so forth, made out of tents. And it was just at the end of the winter time, and they were telling about people being found frozen to death and so forth. They had open sewers. I saw a open market where this was right next to a dusty road, dirt road. Vegetables and so forth were laying on blankets, as meat also. It was just laying on blankets. And at that time, I said I'd never want to go back.
Oh, really? Well, let's go back a little bit. How'd you get involved with the Army? And then maybe you could tell me a little bit about your basic training.
Well, I just simply had graduated. I had a deferment to go to college. I had graduated from college. I knew that I would be drafted at that time, so therefore I enlisted into the officer's candidate school.
Oh, I see.
And I went through basic training at Indian Town Gap. I went through leadership at Indian Town Gap. Basic training was 16 weeks. Leadership was 8 weeks. And of course, they teach you to shoot and get you in top physical condition. Then I went into a 22-week course at Fort Monmouth through officers' leadership's officers' training. And there they... this was a signal corps, and I came out. My primary MOS was signal supply.
Okay, MOS is?
It's your main, I'm not really sure what it means. It means what you are qualified for.
What you can do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I went through Fort Hollaberg Signal Supply School, which was about a 8 weeks course, and then I was sent to Fort Monmouth, Camp Gordon, Georgia, where I spent about 16 weeks there as a executive officer of a basic training school for pole linemen. And then from there, I was assigned to go to Korea. We had choices. My choices were to go to Germany. I forget what my second choice was, and of course, the only other choice was Korea. And that's unfortunately the one they selected, because my wife could have gone with me to Germany, but of course, in Korea, in a wartime way, of course, she could not go.
Could you give me a typical day in basic training? What kind of things did they do?
Well, they usually got us up about 5:30. We went out and did our usual morning calisthenics. Then we would go to the mess hall. Then it was some type of march. We'd either march out, which would be probably a 10-mile march or more, out to the rifle range, and we would spend the morning shooting. Then we would, they would bring lunches out in big garbage cans and so forth, and you'd go along with these metal trays.
What was the food like?
The food wasn't too bad, if you weren't too picky. But they fed you pretty good. Sometimes the food wasn't too good. For instance, every once in a while the cook would make a mistake, and he would have the egg, instead of scrambled eggs, instead of being yellow, would be have a tinge of green to them. And their mainstay seemed to be hamburger gravy on buns, and we had some favorite names
yeah,
for that.
I'm sure.
But food was pretty good. Then what? We would spend the rest of the afternoon shooting, or sometimes we would be in classes and so forth. Then we'd march in, and we'd have our evening meal, and then usually in the evening we were free to do what, you know, a clean up around the barracks and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What about officers? How was it different? Could you go through a typical day?
As an officer, again, I would get up at the, I was living off base at that time. I would have to get up probably about 4:30 to get there at 5:30. And of course, they would assemble, and then you had to accept the report that all were there, or, you know, and so forth. Then you would go to, again, breakfast, and then you would march with them out to the whatever it happened to be. Either they were learning to string wires on short poles. They didn't have the real tall poles because of the danger. They were just mm-hmm. learning. They had poles probably about 10 foot tall, and they had to climb up and stretch wire and so forth. And basically, you didn't do the work. You just sort of stood around and watched what they did and so forth. And then sometimes you'd have reports to do and things like that. But as far as they had special people there, regular instructors. In other words, the officers didn't have to do any of the instructing or anything. It was your job to see that they got out there into the field, and then the instructors would take over from there.
What did they do to train you as an officer?
Oh, we, as I said, a leadership school, how to handle certain situations and so forth. And in OCS, they did pretty much the same thing. You also took you learned radio theory in about 20 hours of instruction. You know, you're mm-hmm. supposed to know how to put a radio together.
Oh, really?
No, basically, I think what they were trying to do is to get us acquainted with a lot of areas, such as, like teletype, radio, how to string wire, you know. They went into a lot of things, not in great detail. Mm-hmm. It was really a crash course. And then, of course, you would take classes on what to do in certain field situations and so forth. I remember the one instance that everybody couldn't quite agree on. But they said, suppose you were in a certain situation where you had a company of drivers driving ammunition trucks, and you had stopped at a certain area, and you were then going through an area where the enemy had zeroed in with their artillery. And for instance, say that the first truck driver refused to get in the truck and so forth, and you were under, you know, in enemy territory, right. What should you do? And of course, the stock answer was shoot him.
Oh, really?
That, you know, because if you let him get away with it, you know, what effect is it? Because, you know, you were in a very dangerous mm-hmm. situation. And so, you know, that sounds kind of harsh, but under a situation like that, I guess there's not too many alternatives.
Do you think your training was adequate for what you experienced later?
Yes, I think so. It was kind of quick, you know, mm-hmm. 22 weeks to, whereas these fellows going to college, they had a four-year training, and of course you go to West Point with four years training. It was minimum, but I think it was adequate for what I had, because I had not planned to be a career soldier.
Mm-hmm. You said you were an executive officer in one of the camps. What's the duties of an executive officer?
Do anything that the officer didn't. I was an executive officer of a company.
Of a company.
Yes, and of course, you do things that your commanding officer of the company tells you to do. Mm-hmm. And of course, we got into a lot of things that, we'd get into reports, daily reports and so forth. You had to send to the next higher ups mm-hmm. the daily reports of who was there and what you did and things like that.
What rank did you have at this
time? I had a second lieutenant.
Second lieutenant. Okay, after all your training, and you went to Korea next?
I went to Korea.
How did they get you there?
We went by, flew to Fort Lawton, Washington. I spent about 3-4 days there. Then they took us by boat to Yokohama, and then they took us by bus to Camp Drake, which is near Tokyo.
What was it like to go across the Pacific on a troop ship?
Well, we had fortunately officers had it pretty nice, in that we were packed six in a little cubbyhole room. We were only two high, and we spent most of the mornings playing cards, and then we spent most of the afternoon we'd be playing bridge or something like that. Going over, you had the full duty, I think, two or three times. I think we spent something like 11 or 12 days going over. And the duty was you were supposed to go through the ship and so forth, and I did get down into the hold of the ship where the non-coms and the lower mm-hmm. ranks were, and that was terrible.
Really?
In that they had bunks five or six high, and there was probably about a foot or a foot 15 inches between bunks, and it smelled terrible. And for instance, if we hit some very, very rough weather going over, we were supposed to go near the Hawaiian Islands, and they were having typhoons there, so we went up near the Aleutian Islands to miss them, but the waves were still, for instance, it was quite a large ship, I don't know, 700 feet long or something mm-hmm. like that, And I remember sitting up in the dining area, and you would see the front end of the ship go down completely underwater.
Wow.
And stay there for a little bit. And then after a while, it'd come up, and the front end would come out of the water completely. And then, bam, it would hit the water again. And it was quite rough. And of course, a lot of these people got seasick. Mm-hmm. Myself, I kept eating Dramamine like candy mints, and I didn't get sick. I had a violent headache, but some of the people down in the hold would get sick, and of course they were in very cramped conditions, mm-hmm. and especially if the top one on the top bunk would get sick, why everybody would get splattered down beneath them. And I know you'd go into the mess hall there, and all it was tables up about 4 feet high or something like that, and they had these tin trays that they served their food on. And it was funny that they would carry it over if they felt like eating. They would carry it over, and then the movement of the ship, the tray would be sliding back and forth, because it was quite rough going over. Coming back, it was very, very smooth, and we had beautiful sunsets coming back, and it was a very nice trip coming back, mm-hmm. in that you'd see the porpoises way off in the distance jumping and so forth, and then you'd look in the where the bow would break the wake and mm-hmm. so forth, you'd see flying fish come out of the water, and they'd go skimming across the water and so forth. And shortly after we left Korea coming back, the water had sort of a phosphorescent tinge to it, in that at night these waves would sort of have a bluish cast to it. And it was a real nice trip coming back. Going over was different.
What were your impressions of Tokyo?
Tokyo, we were very fortunate, again, being an officer. We were Camp Drake. We went through Tokyo over to Yokohama the first day to get a number of shots and so forth. We came back through Tokyo about 10 o'clock in the morning, and the bus driver, there were probably about 25 of us or so on this bus. The bus driver stopped at the corner and says, anybody want out? Just be back at Camp Drake by midnight. And well, how do we get back? He says, just hail a cab and tell them Camp Drake. They understand what that means. So there were two fellows, two first lieutenants got out. They had been over there before. And then there were four of us real green second lieutenants got out. And we started walking down the road, and of course nature's urge hit us. And how do you know, so we look for what we try to find a beer joint or something like that, and there's none around, and we see this great big impressive building, and I think what it was a Japanese post office. So we go up to the counter, and this little Japanese, nice little Japanese girl comes out, and she says something Japanese, and how do you tell her, you know, yeah. you gotta go. And a policeman comes up, and we start talking to him, and who's talking to the gal, and says something about banjo. No, we don't want to play any music. We want to, you know, ooh. Yeah. And finally, he says, points down to, the hall, and then he, you go to the left. And so we take that clue, and we go down the hall, and we line up, go into the restroom there. Banjo is what he was trying to say. That is Japanese for restroom. Mm. And so we line up, and there happens to be four urinals there, so we all line up on the four urinals and so forth. And pretty soon we hear this little click,
and out, and of course the stalls are behind us, and this nice little Japanese girl comes out, and right beside the one fella standing at the urinal, it's where the wash patient is, she goes up and washes her hand, and we just all about died, because that was the first experience. But most of the Japanese merchants could understand you know, English, and it was kind of fun in that when you'd try to buy something there, they expected you to barter,
really?
Because you know, you'd say, okay, this would be 80 yen, and you'd, you know, really talk to them and maybe get them down to 30 or 40 yen. So, you know, they expected. At that time, the Japanese were great imitators, in that, for instance, a Ronson lighter, which would sell for, I don't know, $5 in the United States, you could get it over there for under a dollar. And you really couldn't tell the difference. They were great imitators. They were very industrious people. I think they were still a little leery of the U.S. troops because, you know, less than 6 years before, we had defeated them in a war. So, but it was a very beautiful town. The homes were very well kept. They had, you see these little gardens that they have and so forth, and they do actually exist. They have these, whether it was bonsanza trees or whatever, and they're very, very well manicured and very beautiful. And I remember seeing traffic was terrible, and you would see these people riding bicycles. And this one fella had he was delivering some boxes or something, and on the back end of his bicycle, it must have been 16, these boxes were stacked 16 feet high.
Really?
And he'd go weaving down through that traffic, and I don't know how he ever kept himself from getting killed, but you would see that there were an awful lot of bicycles. And then they had a lot of three-wheeled trucks, in that they would have the one, like a motorcycle wheel in the front, and then they would have the two wide wheels in the back with sort of something like a pickup truck
the bed.
Bed to haul stuff. But I enjoyed Japan. I said I'd like to go back to Japan again.
Then they sent you to Korea.
Then they sent me to Korea.
And where did you go there?
We went in, we took a ship from Yokohama around to Incheon. That's where they had made the landing, I guess about a year before. And there were still a lot of burned out landing barges and so forth. And you could tell that there had been quite a battle there, because there were trucks and so forth burned out. I think I remember seeing a couple of tanks that had been burned out and so forth. And you realize that not all of them made that out of there.
Yeah.
But we then, from Incheon, as I said, I fortunately went south to Pusan. At that time, they were still fighting up around Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went down to Pusan, the refugee city, and as a Korean base officer, when I arrived, there was a major from Massachusetts that was sort of the officer in charge, and I was to be his exec or assistant. And then about three, what our duty was, if anybody in Korea needed signal equipment, it was our job to get the equipment and get it to them. And of course, being a second lieutenant, I didn't know what was going on quite a bit of the time. But about a month or two after I left, after I arrived, he left. Mm. And this called for a light colonel, and which meant, you know, and a poor little second lieutenant like myself, I have fortunately had a very good sergeant who knew what was going on, and he helped me a great deal. And I remember a couple of the instances that we, well, one in particular, the Korean, it was a Korean-based section. The Korean-based section general, they were having quite a time unloading. Busan Harbor is not too large a harbor, and space was at a premium. So that what they would do is they would unload something, like something for the quartermaster, and then they would notify the quartermaster to come pick it up. Well, in the meantime, while they were notifying them, they would then be unloading something else and pile it right on top of it. So when the quartermaster came, why, they couldn't get the stuff till somebody else got their stuff. And what it was, what was happening is the harbor was completely clogged. And so, therefore, the general said, we're going to correct this. I want, what was it, 125 teletypes, so that when a ship comes in, we're going to have a teletype down in the hold of the ship, and we're going to teletype them that we are going to start unloading, get down here pronto, and get this loaded up. Mm-hmm. So that and then of course it was my job to get the 125 teletypes. So what I did, I checked around with all the companies, and of course under TONE, which is I don't know what it means, but it's I did at the time. It's your authorized equipment. If they had it on TONE and they weren't using it, mm-hmm. then they would send it in, and I would order them replacements. Well, I think I got about 50 that way. Then there were about 20, we had none in the Pusan Signal Depot. I sent to Yokohama, and I think they had 50 or 40 in Yokohama Signal Depot, so I sent a request to get those over, and of course we were still short about 35. And so what I did, I sent stateside with an emergency requisition, no authorization except the general's word, to airlift 35 teletypes from the Washington Signal Depot. And of course, any authors, anything like that, why, it goes directly to the Pentagon. And I didn't know what was going to happen, because, you know, ordering stuff with without authorization, but he said get it, so that's what I and then I don't know whatever happened, because I left about 2 months. I only spent about 5 months over there. So it was very interesting. Mm-hmm. But basically, I didn't know what I was doing too much, because, as I said, the job called for a light colonel, which would have had the experience. And being a second lieutenant, I didn't have the experience, but we muddled through.
Yeah. Do you have any problems with black markets or anything like that? You hear a lot about that.
There were some black markets. I didn't really get into it. But I know there. Again, this was a refugee town, and I remember one time I walked up into the market area, and I'd been warned about this. These Korean kids, they were supposed to be going to an orphanage, but they, you know, just walked away from the orphanage, and they really lived on the streets, and they would be gangs of them. And What they would do is they would have a little mirror, and of course on a sunshiny day they would take this mirror and flash it in your eyes. And as they flashed it in your eyes, and of course there'd be probably 20 of these kids all congregating around you, and you really had to watch. For instance, my wife had just sent me a pen and pencil set, brand new one, real good, expensive one, and of course, dip, and it was gone. And they told about one fella that a British officer that was up on the front lines, and he knew he was coming to Pusan. And of course, booze was pretty hard to get up on the front lines. So everybody had given him money, and I think he had around $900 to come down and get booze. And of course, the British uniform has the big pouch pockets, and a gang of kids came around him and again flashed him in the eye and so forth, and somebody had taken a razor blade and slit his pocket, and he was out the $900. And another thing that I remember, tuberculosis in Korea at that time was a very high percentage of the people had it. And I remember seeing this one fella, oh, he must have been, he looked ancient, but I don't imagine he was over 30 or 40. And you could tell he had tuberculosis. His chest was, the center of his chest was sunken way, way, and he just sort of ambled on and so forth. And he, they always sleep on the floor. Koreans sleep on the floor. There's had a low grass mat, and there was this rather nice railroad station that the Japanese had built when they occupied Korea. And he just sort of laid down there on the walkway, you know, and opened up his grass mat, and he laid down there. He was filthy. He had, I don't think he'd had a bath for weeks, and there were flies all over him, you know, and he just was a real pitiful sight.
That was, what, most of the people were very poor that way?
Yes, most of them were very poor.
Of course, these were refugees.
Yes,
so
yes.
So they basically had to get up and leave.
Well, the refugees, see, the war was still going on at that time. And so, you know, they were living any place they could find. I remember seeing under bridges, you know, off to, there was, the main stream was way, way back because of, and you know, in the summertime. Mm-hmm. And they were living in under the bridges. And then you would see lean-tos made out of canvas and so forth that they'd tack up to the under the eaves of a house and just extend it out, and that's where they lived. You know, wintertime got down there, oh, it got down to zero, you know, and canvas is not very much protection. The another thing that I remember about Korea is I remember the Black Widows, the plane, that they were a double fuselage and so forth, like a P-38, except they were much, much bigger. And I remember about 5-6 o'clock every night, they would just take off in droves, maybe 50, 100 of them, I don't know, and they'd head north. Oh. And you know what they were doing.
Yeah. I wasn't familiar with those. That's interesting.
They're like a P-38, except they're much bigger. They have a lot more firepower, and they can carry, you know, quite a bit more bombs and so forth. And you'd see them going up there on just droves about 5 or 6 o'clock. And of course, they'd get up in the north, up into around Seoul and so forth. It would only take them probably an hour and a half, because you talk about Korea. Korea is the size of Ohio. And right now, Korea has, what is it? 40 million people, whereas Ohio has 10 million people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you just take Ohio and put four times as many people, and that's what you have Korea, South Korea, that is.
Any other experiences? And you said you were, what, 2 months after you ordered the teletypes, that you left Korea?
Yes, I left Korea. I was I'll never forget the Department of Army letter number 25 stated that anybody that wanted, any officer that wanted out could, quote, Department of the war ended about the 1st of August.
Mm-hmm.
See, I helped win the war because I was over there. No, and so they knew that the war was coming to an end, and or was over, and they would be, didn't need as many
mm-hmm.
officers and so forth. So they said any officer that wanted to get out could quote Department of Letter Army number 25, and they would, you could get discharged. So I had a real good friend who was down in the comm center. And
what's a comm center?
That's where the communication center,
okay.
Where all the messages come through, regardless of where it's from, it comes through there, and then it's sent to like the commanding general and so forth. Well, this young second lieutenant, a good friend of mine in the comm center, he came up with this Department of the Army letter number 25, and he says, "Hey, look at this." So we both got on the on the typewriter, and we wrote up our request, and we had it on our colonel's desk, commanding colonel of the Signal Corps, before the commanding general even got the letter.
No.
So we both requested immediate discharge. So I went to another camp there where we were supposed to come out, and I requested immediate discharge, so they wrote me up orders to fly home. And some colonel at the center there changed my orders. He says he noticed I'd only been there 5 months, and he says any short timer that's only been here 5 months is certainly not going to fly home. So he changed my orders, and I came home by boat. But I flew home, I'd have been home before my wife would even know it.
Yeah.
I had was coming home. But it was a very favorable experience as far as the Army. I am a firm believer you make out of the Army what you put
mm-hmm.
into it. Like, for instance, if you go in the Army and you say you're not going to like it, somehow the Army just makes it so you don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try to get along in the Army and so forth, why, you know, and I've often said that if I had been recalled, which they were doing to some
mm-hmm.
At that time, if I'd been recalled, I'd have probably tried to stay in the Army.
Mm-hmm. What specific outfit were you with?
I was with the Korean base section. South Korea was really divided into two areas. The fighting unit, the 8th Army and so forth, was up on the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
The Korean base section was in the back, and they were more as the supply,
mm-hmm.
Like signal supply and quartermaster and so forth. In other words, it was our job to watch for infiltrators and so forth, but the biggest thing was to get the supplies to the front lines where they were needed.
What were your feelings about your leadership, the upper officer?
And I don't remember the name, but the colonel we had as far as the signal section, which included the supply, the comm center, the the whole bit. He was a very fine fellow. And Major Kavanaugh, the fellow that was there in the supply section, he had been in the Army for about 20 months, and he was, you know, very knowledgeable, well-liked. He knew what he was doing, and most of the officers that I had throughout the Army, most of them were fine gentlemen, and if you try to get along with them,
no problem.
No problem.
Okay. I think, well, I have to stop here. Okay, I know that you went back to Korea in 1986 as a guest of the Korean
right.
government. You
want right.
to give me a little background about how that came about and
okay.
what you saw?
The mayor from Tioga Falls, who taught part-time classes at Akron U, became friends with a Korean professor who was a friend of quite a few of the upper echelon of Korea. He had graduated with them in college and so forth. So they got to talking, and you know, he told them a little bit about the being in Korea, and they said, wouldn't it be, the Korean professor said, wouldn't it be nice if we could get you back there? So he talked to the upper echelons and so forth, and they came to the they thought it would be terrific. So there was a little article put out in the Ohio Municipal League paper that said anybody that was a mayor at the time could apply and had been in Korea during the war could should have contact this fella from Cuyahoga Falls. So I contacted him, and there was some, it had to be delayed and so forth, but finally there were, what, eight of us went over to Korea, and six wives.
You know, let me note, you were mayor of Newton Falls
yes.
at this time.
Okay. I was mayor of Newton Falls at this time, and there were eight other mayors from Ohio. And six of our wives, two of the wives could not go because they were ill. And this was all picked up by the Korean government. After many delays, we get a call in April and said, the end of April, said, you got your passport in order, and we had ordered it the year before because we wanted, we thought, hey, there may be a chance. So our passports were all in order and so forth, and he says, we're going the last of May. Well, it got delayed till the 1st of June, 1986, and they sent us tickets. We met, and these mayors and so forth, we had never met mm-hmm. them. We met about four of the mayors and three of their wives up at Cleveland Hopkins Airport. We flew from there to LaGuardia. Then we had to transfer to JFK, and we met the rest of the mayors and their wives at JFK. We flew, I believe it was 15 hours, nonstop. From JFK, and of course we made the circle, almost the Aleutian Islands and so forth, and we came down across where the Korean airplane had been shot down. And as I told my wife, I says, if we see a MiGs, why, just wave at them, tell them we're friendly. But we finally landed in Kimco Airport, which is right outside of Seoul. We had no idea what we were going to do or anything. We're just going back to Korea, and we get in there, and after being 15 hours on the airplane, we go through customs and so forth, and we come out into the lobby of the airport, and there's Korean newspapers, televisions, and so forth, And where some of us are in shorts and and after being 15 hours in the airplane, we're all voiced and so forth. And we must have made quite an impression. But anyway, they then load us onto a bus. And finally, Colonel Ahn, who is the executive vice president of the Korean retired army group, he gets up and he says, "Welcome to Korea," and he hands out these booklets, and this is what we're going to do. Before, we had no idea what we were going to do and so forth, and they really treated us royally because they put us up in one of the nicest hotels, which happened to be right next to one of the Korean universities. And a couple of the, with all the student demonstrations and so forth, one of the, or a couple of the mayors met a young fella who was going to that university, and he questioned him about all the student trouble and so forth. And he says, "Oh, there's no trouble here." He says, "Most of that trouble is North Korean inspired."
Hmm.
And he took them through the university. I was kind of jealous. I wish I'd have gone through. But he took them through the university, and he says, "There's no trouble with most of the students," because he said, for instance, the North Koreans tried to take over by military force, and lost. If you can't take over by military force, what do? You use subversion. Mm-hmm. And he claimed that this is the main thing, demonstrations at that time, was almost all of them were North Korean inspired. They sent all types of people down, infiltrated, and of course, students are pretty impressionable,
mm-hmm.
And they get a group of students going, and then they, let's demonstrate, and so forth. But as far as Korea, it was Seoul. I flew up to Seoul once when I was over there in 52. At that time, it was a bombed out city. There was just, a lot of rubble and so forth, very few buildings standing. It had really gone, they'd marched down through it and up through it and down, several times. So there wasn't much left. And this was 7 years later, and you just wouldn't recognize the entire city. You couldn't tell it from Chicago or New York or any place like that, except there were a lot of Koreans running around. And it was tremendous. And there was buildings going on everywhere. Seoul is a city of 9 million people in Seoul, and there's just people every place, and they were building all types of apartment buildings and so forth, because the average Korean could not afford a house. They could afford an apartment and so forth. And another little interesting thing is that our guide, even though he was in an apartment, they still slept on the floor. And it's just sort of tradition, because we went several different places, and we went to one place which was an old kingdom, and they had a house there with tunnels underneath. And we asked him, "Well, what was tunnels for?" And of course, they had no heat. And he said what they would do is they would start a fire out at the end of the tunnel, and then the heat would then go underneath the building. And that's the way they heated their house. And so at night, where's the warmest place to sleep? It's on the floor. Mm-hmm. So that, and of course they have the little grass mats that I mentioned before, and that's what they do. They sleep on the grass mat on the floor, because that was the warmest place. And of course, this is apparently just become tradition. But some of the things that we did, we went to the Korean National Cemetery, which is like our national cemetery in Washington, where all the dead soldiers and so forth are buried, and we placed a wreath there, and it was quite an impressive ceremony. And this was our first acquaintance with any of the school kids. My wife and I, being teachers, were kind of interested. And they brought busload after busload of Korean kids, and they sort of stood back in the parking lot and watched this whole thing. And of course, the walkway down to it, they had Korean military men from all services there, and you talk about being straight. Those, you know, they're like our men at the Arlington Cemetery. Mm-hmm. They're the spit and shine part. But it was a very, very impressive ceremony, and these little kids, they were all dressed in uniforms. Some would have, most of them would have blue shorts on, but some of them would have like a yellow shirt or a blue, light blue shirt or a red shirt or something like that. Both girls and the boys wore uniforms. Then from there, they took us to a dinner where my wife met her favorite admiral. Over in Korea, I sat next to the, my wife was across the table from me and sitting next to the admiral. The admiral's wife was across from him sitting next to me. And so I spoke to the admiral's wife, and he had mentioned she was a teacher, and I says, "Oh, well, you teach?" And she says, and she shakes her head, "Yes." And I said something about, "Well, what grade did you teach?" And she shakes her head, "Yes," you know, very politely. And I found out through that that she cannot speak English. Over there, the men get out, but the women, most of them do not get out. And of course, it's a very male-dominated type of family arrangement. And at first, my wife was sitting next to him, and he was talking to the other mayors that were sitting at the table and so forth. And finally, I forget what you said, but oh, I know, it was something about a fur coat or something, and he says, "You buy her fur coat." And she started in the conversation and so forth. But in a Korean society, that is not known too well.
Yeah.
And so then a couple of the other things that we went to, we did go up to the 8th Army. We did go to Panmunjom, where the army, technically South Korea and North Korea is still at war. Mm-hmm. They have signed a peace agreement, but technically they're still at war. And we were always at Panmunjom. We drove in with our buses, and you look over on the North Korean side, there's a great big impressive building. But the thing is, they tell you that it's only 5 foot thick, or no, 13 foot thick. And it was funny. They had the curtains and so forth, and you kept seeing curtains moved. And you knew darn well you were being watched from the North Korean side. And about a week before we were there, they had a group of North Koreans apparently showing them from the North Korean side. One fella made a break for it, and he ran across the demilitarized line through underneath, and we have the South Koreans have a elevated sentry post. It's sort of an octagon thing where 24 hours they have somebody there looking. Mm-hmm. you know, with field glass and so forth. He ran through underneath that and back into a nice little garden they had, and then into the brush behind it. Well, shortly later, there were some North Korean soldiers came down through, and one of the South Korean soldiers got a hold of this fella and led him away, and he defected successfully. But in the meantime, while they were looking through the bushes and so forth, there got to be a little argument, and there was a firefight started, and one of the South Korean soldiers were killed. And of course, there's nothing they could do about it because they're technically at war with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they're down at one of the sentry stations, which was another area, oh, about a half mile away. There was what is known as the Bridge of No Return. And this is a bridge across a gorge between North and South Korea, and there's a sentry post on both sides, north side and south side. This is where all the soldiers were exchanged, prisoners of war and so forth. And you remember Captain Butcher from Palebo? He was returned at this Bridge of No Return, and there have been remains and all kinds of things that have exchanged there. But right, they had this sentry post here, and then way off on about a quarter of a mile away, they had another sentry post. But in between that sentry post, there was a tree. And this tree sort of blocked to see what was going on at the other sentry post, because this one was right down next to the bridge, and they couldn't exactly see what was going on down there, and they wanted to chop this tree down. So they sent a lieutenant with a enlisted man down to chop the tree down. There were about eight North Korean soldiers came across the bridge, and they started talking to them, and they don't know exactly what happened, but anyway, this lieutenant and the soldier were killed with their own axes. And of course, then the powers to be said, we're going to chop the, and of course, again, they can't do anything about it because they're still at war. Mm-hmm. And so the powers to be says, we're going to cut that down. So what they did, they brought in a carrier and put it off Incheon, which is about 20 miles away. They brought in a full regiment of soldiers into the Zone B, and by agreement, Zone A, they can only have so many soldiers in there. But Zone B, which is back about a mile, they can bring in as many as they want. So they brought in a whole regiment of soldiers. They had planes flying, you know, from the battle wagon, and from the carrier, and from Seoul and Busan. They had all equipped with bombs ready to go. They then took a company of Korean soldiers who were veterans and had all black belts, and they were, you know, they were their cream of the crop, and they just stood around the tree, and then somehow they just were able to cut the tree with no interference, so that they call it the most expensive tree trimming in the world. But after the first couple of days where we did our formal type of things, they then took us all to a couple Buddhist temples. They took us to a Korean village, which is like the Hale Farm and mm-hmm. so forth. It's all the older. And there we were very pleasantly surprised in that one young lady with her brother and apparently her mother and father, she said, and of course it had been on the Korean radio TV that we were there, and she says, are you the Ohio mayors? And we said, yes. And she says, well, that seat on behalf of Korea would like to thank us for saving their country. And so, you know, it was kind of heartwarming to have somebody that didn't even know you to, she really, I think, felt that way. And so, you know, there are demonstrations against the United States, but there are some people that are very thankful for what we did during the Korean War. And it was, the Korean village was very interesting in that one of the things the our guide took, and we had green bean pancakes and with soy sauce on it. And it doesn't sound, you know, at first, but it was pretty good. They just simply ground up green beans, mixed it in with the pancake batter and so forth, and then fried it, and then you had soy sauce on it and so forth. Then they took us to the Korea House, which is a sort of a stage, a dinner stage type thing. We went into this one room. First we went into the room, into the building. We had to leave our shoes in cubby holes, and we put on slippers. We went down this little walkway, or hallway, to the room. We then left our slippers at the doorway, and then we went in, and we sat on the floor. Fortunately, they had little seat cushions with backs to them, but I understand that sometimes they don't even do that. But we were, and we had all types of Korean food. We had kimchi, we had pine nuts, had all types of things that were, and most of it was pretty good. The hot kimchi was pretty hot, but
what's kimchi?
Kimchi is a Korean dish that if somebody's making kimchi, I remember back in 52, if somebody's making kimchi, you can smell it for miles. What they do is they take peach heads and or you know, fish and rice and cabbage and so forth. They cook it, and then they leave it ferment. And that fermenting may take as much as 3 or 4 months. And when it's fermenting, you can smell it for miles. And after a Korean has been eating kimchi, if they eat a lot of it, you can smell it on their body odor. You know, it's probably something like garlic or something, but you can actually smell it on their body odor. In other words, when we had girls taking care of some of the rooms in the BOQ, they were ordered, "Thou shall not eat kimchi if you're going to work here," because they could smell it. But Korea, the changes in Korea was the city, it was tremendous, the building that was going on. And of course, they were getting ready for the Olympics also. And it just seemed everybody was so industrious and clean. You know, around here, beer bottles and so forth around. There you saw nothing because they had people going around cleaning up. And I think the Koreans just took a great pride in their country. And you would see people, street workers, working all the, you know, round the clock. For instance, this one park, they were repairing it. And you'd see them out there, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning or so forth. We also did get to go through the Samsung electronics plant, and we got to go through the Hyundai auto plant. And again, as far as the auto plant, we've been through General Motors, and it looked very similar, with the exception, these fellows, you know, they did not have relief operators. They were expected to be on the job, you know, and
if they got sick, that's too bad, or, you know. And what they did, they worked 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week. And what they would do is they would come in, and the company then would provide two meals a day for them. You know, the, if they were in midnight turn, they'd get two meals, a day turn, they'd get two meals. And the company would help them buy houses and so forth. It was really quite an honor to work for, and the wages were much better than the average wage. I think at that time, they were earning about $400 a month, I believe. And that was real good money for them, you know, and very, very industrious. And the plants were clean. Even, we did also go through a steel mill. And I've been down through public steel, dirty and so forth. This steel mill had trees planted down along the driveway, you know, and so forth. And it was so much cleaner than Republic Steel and so forth. They just seemed so industrious. The other thing we noticed, Korea does not know democracy as we know it. It's still pretty much a police state, that, you know, they do have elections and so forth, but the individual freedoms that we have, they just don't have the freedom over there. It is pretty much, and of course, maybe it's because there's so many people, they have to be this way, but they don't seem to have the freedom that we have here. The other thing we notice is the transportation. With 9 million people, the average person cannot afford a car, but the highways are still plugged, and then they have a bus system, and you know, the buses, they're parked, they're seated two or three in a seat, and then even the aisleways are so plugged, they're two or three, you know, it must be under the, you know, commercial dial, because they just had so many, and the there would be one bus right after another bus after another bus. It was just, also we did get to go to see the mayor of Seoul and also the assistant director of, or the assistant prime minister, or, you know, president, it would be a vice president here. And the thing they would do is they would feed you what's the drink,
Jensen.
What this is a little something like a turnip, and they make a tea out of this. And this tea is supposed to cure all your ills, including your sex ills.
Oh, really?
And the wives were not permitted to go because, again, this is a very male-dominated culture. And the wives were not permitted to go, but they would serve you this ginseng tea, and they were very cordial, and of course we got a lot of little trinkets. While we're over there, we got the Freedom Fighter Award. Korean government presented each mayor with a Freedom Fighter Award, but it was a very in a, there was so much difference between Korea in 52 and Korea in 86. It just was tremendous, the difference. Of course, you have to realize they were at war. They were, almost all of Korea had been captured, and then they pushed them back to the 38th parallel, and it's a very beautiful country. It's a very rocky country, but technically there's still war. When we were talking to the commanding general of the 8th Army, he was saying that we know that North Korea is making plans or to invade South Korea again, and they have the Department of Defense, the person in charge said, give me the okay and I'll have all of South Korea within a week. And he says, we know what they're going to do. He says, Korea has mountains going north and south. They have valleys going north and south. And we know that they have spent 25% of their national budget on warfare. And a good bit of this is going into tanks. And they have tank after tank after tank battalions. And to compare 25%, I think South Korea is spending like 5% on military defense. So they're spending a large percentage of their national budget on military, and they know that what they're going to do is, if it ever comes about, that they're going to take their tanks and run right down south. And of course, he says, we have things to counteract this. He says, we can't tell you what it is, but he says, this is what we feel is coming, and we're taking measures to meet it, if it ever comes. And I know going from Seoul up to Panmunjom, we passed through sort of a guard area, in that for as long as you can look, there's a hill of dirt that's built up, and the hill must have been about 30 feet high. Where the roadways go through, there's bridges there, and then they have little things that look like giant jacks, and they're sitting off to the side. That what they plan to do is they'll throw those in there in the case there is a tank. They say they know that these hills and this is not going to stop them, because all they have to do is, of course, blast away, and they'll blast a hole through it. But they said, at least this is going to be a deterrent, so that if it comes, we can then have a little bit of time to counteract wherever they're coming and so forth. So yeah, they're still at war over there.
One last quick question, then we can finish up. We hear a lot about Vietnam and its veterans today, and very little about Korea. How do you feel about that?
Well, there has been some voice in this, and I understand. In fact, the only monument for the Korean War built by United States is over in Korea itself. It's just south of Panmunjom. And yeah, it's I feel that there should have been, and I understand there is some method or some movement to get a Korean monument.
Well, I appreciate you taking all this time to talk to me. If there's anything else to finish up.
No, my wife and I, it was quite an experience, and
we'd like to go back to Korea again. Because they are very industrious, they're very friendly people, the students are very very well mannered and so forth, and every time you would see them, it's come up sundida, and they'd bow and so forth, which means hello, how are you, and so forth. They're very nice people. However, one last comment. I said earlier that I'd like to go to Japan.
Yeah.
And I sort of changed my mind in that when we were in the hotel, Japan is only about 100 miles across the bay from South Korea. So there's an awful lot of Japanese that come over there for vacations. And there was a whole busload of Japanese pulled into this hotel. They come, we're standing there waiting on the elevator to go upstairs. These Japanese come up and they sort of give you the shove and so forth, and standing either right beside you or standing in front of you. And the elevator comes down, and I remember this old Japanese lady. She was standing right beside me, and she gives me an elbow right square in the chest that knocked the wind out of me almost. And she busts into the elevator before the other people have a chance to get up. And the rest of the Japanese, the same way, they bust right into it and so forth. And we saw them other places. And they are the most ill-mannered people that you can ever imagine. And just from that, I sort of lost my desire to go. It was completely different. The Koreans are very polite, very, they can't do enough for you and so forth. And that maybe the Japanese were on vacations or something and wanted to be known as a tourist, but they were very, very rude.